Mental health costs alone in terms of productivity and absenteeism across the workplace is up to $23 billion a year. And that's before we even look at, the impact of sleep, loneliness. There's a whole range of health and wellbeing concerns that collectively we need to solve for. So the Wellbeing Conference or the Digital Health Fest was a great place to bring together those minds and learn what people are doing now, but also where we need to be focusing on in the future.
Hello and welcome to the Brand My Career podcast. I'm your host, Alex Cutterford, and I'm so glad you're joining me today. My goal is to help you take ownership of your career, find your people through personal branding and networking, and take career-enhancing action. Managing your life and career can be hard. That's why every fortnight I'll be releasing an episode where I interview a diverse range of guests that will help you find clarity, build confidence in your career. Let's get into it.
Well, hello and welcome back. And today I am joined by Melanie. Now, Melanie is a corporate health and wellbeing specialist with Medibank. And I'm really excited to have you on the podcast today to have a chat about all things wellbeing.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here. So thank you for the invitation.
My pleasure. So really keen to jump in. I thought maybe we could start this. Could you just give a little overview about what your job is?
Yeah, absolutely. So my role, and it is a mouthful to get out, so well done, Corporate Health and Wellbeing Specialist with Medibank. For anyone that's not familiar with Medibank, we're an Australian corporate health insurance company that sells health insurance, health services, and my role is working with our external and corporate business partners to put in place corporate health and wellbeing programs that really create workplaces where we've got happier and healthier humans. And our vision, it's actually a really good reason to get out of bed in the morning. Our vision is to create the healthiest workplaces by 2030 and the best health for all Australians by 2030 as well. So sitting under there, as you can imagine, is a whole heap of things that need to happen to elevate us towards those goals. But my role primarily is working with those corporate organizations across a whole range of industries. That can include hospitals, universities, mining, construction, corporate, to work with their HR, health and wellbeing, health and safety people to put in place a corporate health and wellbeing program and strategy. And it's I often think that I'm biased that I've got one of the best roles in the company because I not only get to work within Medibank, but I get to work with some incredible people that are looking at how the workplace can be a place of a positive change, of creating workplaces where people can come to work and to thrive and creating healthier workplaces of the future. So pretty lucky, love my role and what I do.
Yeah, that sounds like an awesome job.
Yeah, it is.
Really fun. So I'm really keen to dive into a whole bunch of different elements of that as we go through the chat. But I do know you've just come back from, was it the Digital Health Festival?
It was, yeah. So over 2 days in Melbourne last week. Incredible. It was bringing together a whole group of organisations and companies that are invested in how we shape and change health and wellbeing into the future. And when we look at the need for that, we have huge amounts of chronic disease. We have 20 million Australians with a chronic disease. Mental health costs alone in terms of productivity and absenteeism across the workplace is up to $23 billion a year. And that's before we even look at, the impact of sleep, loneliness. You know, there's a whole range of health and wellbeing concerns that collectively we need to solve for. So the Wellbeing Conference or the Digital Health Fest was a great place to bring together those minds and learn what people are doing now, but also where we need to be focusing on in the future, the role of AI in healthcare and innovation, while also keeping it very human-centric as well, which is key.
Yeah. That was 23 million or billion, did you just say?
23 billion, which is a lost productivity, absenteeism, which is being at work but not feeling like you're able to do your best when you're there, and then also workers' compensation claims. That was a Black Dog Institute report, I think, from 2022. So those statistics will change. But what it does highlight is just that need within organisations to take a really proactive and preventative approach to mental health and overall wellbeing. well-being in the workplace, and also remove some of those barriers to health and well-being as well. You know, we hear a lot around burnout, workplace stress, and so really looking at, as an organisation, how can we shift and change how we work, which hasn't changed in a long time. If you think of the way that we work in terms of the Industrial Revolution, 9-to-5 work days, 40 hours a week, but now we have digital technology, hybrid workplaces, so how we need to work, how we work needs to change along with that, and we've got a great opportunity to do that.
Yeah. Okay, so the how we work piece. So like where's the starting point for that conversation? Maybe it's either a business thing or an individual. Like where's the starting point for that change in how we work?
Yeah, good question. I can share with you what we're doing internally at Medibank on how we work. And we've actually called it Work Reinvented, which is one of our biggest cultural organisational shifts that we've gone through. And it really is challenging some of those traditional ways of working that I just mentioned and looking at what we want work to look like in the future. And to do that, we asked our 4,000 employees how they want work to be, what makes good work, what removes some of those barriers to well-being, and how can we create that as an organisation? So it's been a very people-led and people-centric approach. And also one where you need that leadership endorsement and culture shift as well to achieve it. And there were some really simple, easy wins that we got out of there, like less meetings. I'm sure everybody would love those. Yeah. Or making sure that the meetings that we do have are effective, that, you know, does it need to be a meeting every month or can it be every week? Does it need to be an hour or can it be half an hour? So, and what that did was created more space in people's calendars that we could look after our well-being. We could go for a walk. We could, you know, eat lunch, have a bathroom break, as simple as it might be. But yeah, we'd gone to this hybrid way of working without really looking at how we work. Another easy win from that was looking at our work processes. So we know that flexibility and autonomy are two key enablers of individual well-being. So how can we remove some of that red tape and processes so people were employed to be able to do their work and create wonderful things, not to work through processes? So how do we remove some of those barriers? And probably the most exciting one was we've also been running a pilot on a 4-day work week, which I am fortunate to be part of the pilot group of 250 people across the organisation, looking at how we can increase our productivity, but also look after our health and wellbeing in 4 days, but by reducing our work day into 4 days instead of the traditional 5.
Mm. Yeah, wow. And what do you think is... what's the challenge for a business actually being able to like hear that and go, someone might hear that and say, that sounds great. How, like, what's the challenges stopping organizations from embracing that, do you think?
Yeah, look, there's a few. I think the biggest one is that health and well-being needs to be a strategic priority. It can't be something that sits on the side as a tick box activity or a program, separate program. It really needs to be embedded into the organization as part of their culture, as part of how we look after our people, and as being the right thing to do. It also does make business sense to have that as well. Yeah. So from that very top culture piece, we need to get that right with the why. Sitting under that, we need to really support our leaders to enable that as well in looking after our leaders. Their roles have changed quite a lot. Instead of being individual contributors going into leadership roles, they're also responsible, I think especially post-COVID too, for a lot of that emotional side, mentoring, coaching of their people. So to do that, they need to be able to look after themselves and their well-being, but also nurture that within their team and identify if somebody is not doing well and reduce that time of somebody needing help versus something escalating. Mm-hmm. So really working on that leadership capability and upskilling. And then sitting under that is then where the programs and the interventions come in. So we've got to get all those pieces right. Yeah. But sitting at the top of it is that strategic embedding of a health and wellbeing program. Mm.
Yeah, so the starting point really is at the top, they have to actually value their employees' wellbeing enough to make it a strategic priority of the business.
Absolutely. And it starts with why. Like often when I'm working with organizations on their corporate health and wellbeing strategy, and every organization is different. So there really is no one size fits all, because it has to reflect your own business vision and values as well. So often we'll start with why and what you want to achieve and what that workplace looks like. If they're looking at 12 months or 3 years down the track, what are some of those key priorities that need instant fixing and can have the biggest impact? But also what type of culture and workplace would you like to create through that process as well?
Yeah. So I'm typically seeking to speak to someone in their career that's sort of trying to either take ownership of their career, they want to progress their career. If someone, ideally someone's ended up in an organization that does have this as a priority. If someone's in a job where maybe it's not a priority, or maybe it is, there's maybe some elements that have been put in place, but it hasn't fully been implemented to really drive great outcomes for wellbeing. They're in their job. Maybe they enjoy their job, but there's elements that they're struggling with and their wellbeing suffering. What are some things that that person could be doing whilst they're in that environment to keep on top of their own wellbeing?
Yeah, great question as well, because we do see this a lot, and it's that combination of what individual action can you change and what's the responsibility or duty of care from an organisation to look after the wellbeing of that person as well. From a personal perspective, I'm a huge advocate in doing what you can. My background is also a nutritionist, so I'm very focused on that whole picture of wellbeing, and it's having a look at what are those barriers to your own well-being at the time. And when we look at health holistically, we've often got stress, our mental health, physical health, sleep, nutrition. So is there a pocket or in an area that's standing out that needs that focus first? And then it could be taking that next step to get professional help, whether it's your GP, healthcare provider, psychologist, a coach, and really working on your individual well-being and getting to the bottom of what some of those causes might be. From a workplace perspective, the best place to start, and again, it depends on the relationship, but working with your leader as well, I think there's a role that we can play in taking control and empowering our own career path as well, and having that conversation, if it's in that right environment, that you might need some temporary changes to workload, or is there an opportunity for more flexibility? And I know sometimes that's easier said than done. It's something that I did struggle with when I first went back to work after having children, and I found working full time and having two little kids at the time really tough. And this was in a supportive organization. So I get that it's not always an easy conversation to have, but I think the more people are having it, it also lets the leader, your leader, be aware of what you need as well. They just might not realize that you're having these challenges. And so being able to advocate for yourself in terms of what you need, and experimenting as well. It might just be making a little change, seeing how that works, and then moving on to the next thing that could create an impact.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting that element, like that relationship with the maybe your direct manager and how important that really is. I even just think to when I was managing a team and I really did want to be available and caring for my team and caring about their well-being and them as a person as much as them as a executor of whatever task that they have to do for their job. But I also found it hard to know where to find that balance of how to engage in that. And especially like for me, like pretty sure I don't think I had a man on my team. So I had a full team of females, and so you know you're trying to work out the balance of how to be supportive. And I remember one of them had taken a day for, they were sort of like, I'm this, you know, really tired, burnt out, been going really hard. I just need to take a day. And I'm like, yeah, no, that's all good. And then I think I sort of heard, like down the track, I sort of heard, oh, like it sort of came back to me that she'd maybe a bit hurt that I hadn't checked in following that.
Yeah.
But then there's sort of this part in my mind of going like, I don't want to probe, like I don't want someone to feel uncomfortable. If someone comes to me, I'm happy to have a conversation. So it gets murky when you get into the world of work and how you support people. What would you have any advice for someone in that scenario?
Yeah, look, I think to your point, you can't underestimate the importance of that leadership relationship. There was a study done recently that they can have a 6% impact on somebody's mental health and well-being, which can be just as significant as our partners, our friends, or other things happening in our life. And so I think having that communication pathway is just so important. But in terms of, I lost where I was going with that train of thought. Look, I think it's from a leadership perspective, it's important to have that coaching and mentoring element. But to your point, it's also important to have those boundaries there as well. And that was a mistake that I initially made in leadership roles. I would get way too involved, it was the right thing at the time, but it also burnt me out a bit, quite a lot as well, because I was taking everybody else's problems home with me. I felt like I had to be the one to fix everything, not just in their work life, but in their personal life. So for me, from personal experience, it was learning where to put in those boundaries of setting up that, being able to firstly have somebody feel that they could come and talk to you. So I think that's the very first step, is that availability. And sometimes that comes from your own vulnerability as well, of being able to share what you've got in your life. It has to be that two-way relationship, as leaders are also very human beings with their own personal lives and different things going on. So I think the more that you can connect on that personal level rather than that leadership and employee level definitely helps that next stage in a conversation of having that trust of somebody being able to say to you, look, this is going on. And not fearing that it's going to have any repercussions on your job future or job safety, that they think that you're not coping or whatever it might be, that it becomes a solution-based discussion. Yeah. And then also what I learned was knowing when to refer as well, when if they needed to see their EAP or HR, or not feeling that you have to, as a leader, take all of that on, but what's going to be the best pathway in that, what's the best way that you can support that person to really, you want to empower them to take those next steps as well.
Yeah.
And provide that environment where you can do that.
Absolutely. And I think that sort of speaks to the fact that even if you're not in a company that maybe has it happening right from the top, there are still things that everyone on every level can be doing within their sort of immediate area of influence. But it definitely then highlights how much more powerful and effective it can be when it is coming from the top, because it sort of builds in that confidence for people to know how to approach things rather than you're just trying to work it out yourself within the midst of things. And other people might do it differently or think differently about that approach to you and within the organization. And yeah, so there are things that you can do, and you're never sort of completely trapped in a scenario to have no options, but it highlights how powerful it can be if it's coming from the top down.
Yeah. And I think also vice versa, understanding the some of the pressures that a leader might be under in terms of targets. So if you're going to them with if you need flexible work, for example, demonstrating how you're going to still meet targets or what types of revisions, so that it's not impacting on the bigger part of the business. So you're in that together, that it becomes a two-way partnership of what you need and how you're going to still help the team get to where they need to be as well. And then I think if it's an organization where it's really not working for you and you've tried everything else, it might be a matter of chatting to HR or speaking to other mentors or people that might have got through that in other circumstances or organizations, or perhaps there's even another department that you could move into where you're better suited, or it's a better match for your skills or what you need.
Yeah. Hey, Alex here. Just wanted to reach out to everyone and say thank you so much for following along with the Brand My Career podcast. I'm really loving having the conversations that I'm having and bringing this content to people. I want to keep bringing more content to people. I want to bring stories of people's career journey. And one of the ways that I can be doing that is by getting your support. And one of the ways you can do that is by shouting me a coffee. On my website, you can find the link to shout me a coffee to help me keep bringing more content, building what I already have done and improving it, getting better, getting more and more people on and sharing their career stories and the lessons that they've learned along the way. So thank you for following along. And would you consider getting on board and helping me take it to new heights? So a common pushback that you would that I've heard to the around flexible work arrangements. Instead of going, well, if we do that for this person, then it's kind of going to open the floodgates of a free-for-all of when people are working and where they're working, all of that, and there's a resistance to that because I think the resistance is to losing control. What do you say to that pushback? How would you approach that?
Firstly, flexibility needs to be fair. Often it was something that felt like it was reserved for parents who had to leave to pick up their children. So flexibility, of course, that's important and I appreciate that benefit. But it also needs to be available for everybody in the organisation, whether it's to leave early to exercise, to study, to look after parents, or you've got a caring role. So making it something accessible for everybody. But then also having a look at work structure as well, that how do you, with a flexible work culture, get that work done? What are those agreed team working rhythms and patterns that you agree on together so that you can have that flexibility but also have that same level of productivity? And then also, I think it really comes from a place of trust too. I think there's very few people that do abuse flexibility because it is such a privilege to be able to have it. So what we've seen is that people will, you know, will work harder, will produce those outputs, will often work when they do have the option for flexibility because they believe in what they're doing and what their team and that level of trust, rather than starting with a place of I don't trust you and I'm trying to catch you out of, you know, of not doing the right thing, yeah. Which is very rare. It becomes a two-way street in how we manage flexibility versus setting up the right structure for it to work well,
yeah,
and making it available to everybody.
I want to turn it back towards you for a moment in terms of your career journey. So how did you move into this space?
If I'd have told my 18-year-old self that this is where I'd end up, I would have been very happy with it, but also very surprised at the same time. When I left school, my goals were to become a professional dancer. Still be the last one on the dance floor, but never quite made it as a professional dancer.
But I also really dance floor now.
That can be a whole new podcast. But the other things that I wanted to do was to be a journalist and a psychologist and travel the world. So I left school and thought I could tick off two of those boxes at uni. So I did a combined arts and psychology degree and did the first year and a half and realised that I loved studying and loved learning, but wasn't really sure that I wanted to do either of those in a competitive industry and have the next 4 to 6 years of doing that plus all the student debt that came with it. So I decided to use that debt wisely and I bought a one-way ticket to London. And, although I took a gap year, I'm pretty certain, I never ended up going back to university. And I often wonder, you've got those career paths, how do I finish? Where would I have ended up? But to me, traveling was the best thing that I could have done. I had no career aspirations. I got there and my goal was to make as much money as possible and see as many countries as I could. And from a career perspective, though, it was putting yourself in these situations where you're often applying for jobs where you have no skills. I think I was the world's worst PA, the world's worst receptionist, terrible at silver service, very clumsy. But it put you out of your comfort zone and you had to go for roles and meet people all the time and create these networks. That was wonderful. But what I didn't realize was it would set me off on this career trajectory as well, that I met somebody over there who was a travel agent and I thought, that's pretty cool. I can make money and travel the world. So I came back to Sydney and applied for a job at Flight Centre. Turns out telling them you just want to travel the world and make money is not a good interview response, but thankfully I still got the job. And I think I'm terrible at interviews actually, but anyway, we'll save that one for the next podcast too. But thankfully somebody saw something there and I ended up, I'm not sure whether it's because I didn't finish university, but I decided to make that my career, and Flight Centre had fantastic foundations in sales training, leadership training, and within 12 months I'd gone on to become a team leader and then managed multiple stores and went on to a national leadership and training mentoring role, which was fantastic because it taught you not only the business basics around profit and loss, you know, creating memorable customer experiences. I did still get to travel and make money, so that was great. Mm-hmm. But it was the leadership skills that really carried me outside of Flight Centre. So my next role from there was at Air Canada as a national sales manager. And that was a great experience in working for a global organization, but in a smaller offshore base in Australia. And it meant that I was across all of their different profit and loss centers, reservations, ticketing, marketing, customer solutions, worked very closely with the GM, who was wonderful. And we had a great time. I think in all of the roles, you know, having fun is important as well. But I went in there and I kind of went from knowing a lot at Flight Center to feeling like I was starting again. And somebody said to me, you're not employed to know everything. Your role is to bring out the best in people. And I had a team from 21 to 64 years of age. You know, all of them had different skill sets, and I really wanted to feel that they could nurture that and follow their strengths, and together we could do something collectively amazing. So that gave me a lot of skills in how to manage different people, but also from a career development side around strategy, you know, contract negotiations, working with trade officers and government bodies. But then I got to the point, I think the higher you go, it became more about spreadsheets and credit to anybody that loves spreadsheets, but it wasn't my strength. Yeah. And I guess I got back to that passion piece is where I'm going with the story of I really wanted to do something where I felt like I was making a difference and making an impact. And nutrition had always been interesting to me for the reasons that I explained before around just when we look at our health and we can get it right, life just becomes easier. You know, we feel like getting out of bed in the morning, we're more productive at work. We often talk about Medibank about health and well-being as being our superpower that helps unleash human potential. And I love that because I feel like it's, you know, you never reach that end point. You're like, yes, I'm healthy now, tick. It's a work in progress constantly as life changes and we change. But, you know, to have the energy to do the things that you love, whether that's at work or at home. So that led me into studying nutrition, which I did while I was working full time. And then from there, I started my own business as a clinical nutritionist doing one-on-one consultations and corporate health, which was, again, another big learning curve. But I also thought, I've just finished studying. Who's going to employ me? I'll just set up my own business.
It's like who's going to employ me? Instead, I'll do a way harder thing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like you can convince yourself that you can run your own business, but you can't convince yourself that someone would want to employ you. It's a funny thing.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it was great that I had that background in sales and leadership and running businesses, but also I got to a chance to really tap into that creative side of designing programs. I actually went back to Flight Center and asked them if I could be their in-house nutritionist and design corporate health and wellbeing programs, which was great. Going back to what I knew in an area industry that I knew. So leveraging those contacts and past experience. So even though it was going completely from one industry in travel and aviation into health and wellbeing, I was able to merge the two, which worked out really well.
Yeah, that's awesome. And that actually gets to something that I was going to ask you around job crafting. I know that's something that you're interested in, that sort of ties into that. Do you want to share what is job crafting and how can people be considering that in their own career journey?
Yeah, and I think because I've had quite longevity in most of my roles, and the reason that I've had that is that, you know, you can become a bit stagnant if you've been doing the same role for a long time, but it also doesn't need to be that way. So job crafting to me is being able to tap into some of your strengths or areas that you want to grow into. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a big change, but it does give you the safety of doing it that in the role that you're in, but also trying something new. So an example of that is going back to that wanting to be a journalist. One of the things that I'd always wanted to do and have done some courses along the way was become a writer. So in my role in Medibank, and I'd had some work published previously around health and wellbeing and lifestyle writing, and I approached our marketing team if I could write some articles for our website and bring that customer voice to Medibank and my internal experience as well as writing. And I thought, they're going to say no. And thankfully they said yes, which led on to writing a whole a range of different articles and white paper reports and even a cookbook. But, you know, it was job crafting in terms of that was a strength that I wanted to do, but I still loved my role that I was in and didn't necessarily want to change. I just needed a challenge and I wanted to do something that was a little bit more creative and could help me build on that. So, you know, when got my leadership approval to do that, to put myself out there to ask somebody. And three, I think if I read that first article, I'd probably cringe a little, but yeah. It was that starting point. So I think with job crafting as well, it's, you know, starting somewhere and just taking that first step of action, which will then lead to the next one. We don't always have to know where you're going to end up with it, but job crafting gives you that ability to just experiment along the way. Mm. And then that one thing might lead to another and might lead to another. And all of a sudden you've got a whole new area in your role that you didn't have, but it's kept you in that role. It's also, a great way to get change.
It's kind of pulling the thread, isn't it? It's just like you just pull the bit of thread and who knows where it's going to end up.
Exactly. And I think if I look at my career path, I've always followed what I'm interested in as well. It hasn't always been this is where I'm going to end up, but what have I enjoyed along the way and what's one little step that I can take to getting there, sometimes bigger steps. But you're right, I like that analogy of pulling the thread because it does all link.
Yeah, and next thing you know, you're wearing a sweater. Then next thing you know, it's summer and now you want to take the sweater off because it's too hot, and then you're moving to something completely different. And yeah, and then you suddenly sit there going, I'm happy with where I am, but how did I get here?
Exactly. And that's when job crafting is great. You can have both.
Yeah, exactly. It's awesome. I had the same thing happen when I had originally worked as a cabinet maker. So I did my apprenticeship in cabinet making and then I sort of moved into youth work. But I was in sort of a lot of casual employment. And then I was really keen to be finding some full-time work. And then a full-time role came up looking for someone with trade experience and youth work experience to be in a mentoring role for apprentices. And so it felt like this little golden nugget falling from the
sky. Absolutely.
Took that, and that's where I then ended up moving. That program finished and I moved into different career development roles, and that's where I sort of really fell in love with career development. And then things just keep rolling and new opportunities come, and all of a sudden you look back and you think, I was just a cabinet maker.
Who also did your own job crafting along the way and ended up with your own podcast.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny. Very cool. Of my interview guests has put language to things that I'm talking about, but don't necessarily have the language for. And that when you said job crafting, I was like, yeah, that's a good term. I understand that. I didn't know that's what I was doing. That's what it was called, but yeah, it's great. So I want to jump back onto some of the things that you mentioned. So you're talking about wellbeing AI was like a conversation at this hustle. What's happening in that space that's supporting businesses and people in wellbeing?
Yeah, and look, I think one of the challenges with, especially if we're looking at corporate health and wellbeing, is how do we create impact at scale, organizational wide, but still have that very personalized focus and being able to really, you know, create programs that's, you know, what you might need at this particular time of life might be very different to what I need. And you can imagine a whole workplace of people like that. Yeah. So what AI is enabling is people to customize and create their wellbeing content, but often powered by digital apps and wellbeing programs that are catered. So what we're seeing is more accessible health and wellbeing programs by being able to create that, high contact but, you know, personalized touch. A lot around femtech as well, moving into that space. And then a lot around personalization when you look into the hospital and medical space as well. You know, it can be a very fragmented system and a little bit disjointed. So how do you create that continuity in terms of patient care as well? And for you, if you were seeing multiple people, how do you create those? So I think, it's huge. It's already here. There's a lot happening in this space. It's just how do we harness it to make it user-friendly and drive that change that we spoke about at the beginning, at reducing some of those risk factors around chronic disease and empowering people to look after their mental health and well-being.
Yeah, awesome. And on that strategy side of businesses, so What would be some of the starting questions for, say, you're a CEO or a people and culture manager in an organization, and say you're listening to this and you're like, yeah, no, I want to take this serious. I want to make this a strategic priority. What are some of the beginning questions that they should start grappling with and asking themselves and their, maybe their leadership team to be thinking about?
Yeah, and that's a great point. It needs to be a collaborative approach as well, and led by multiple, you know, cross-collaborative people within the organisation. So sitting at that CEO level, but also HR, communications, people and culture, IT, legal. But going back a step, we actually run a discovery tool session, which is exactly for that. The where do I start and how do I do it and how do I build a framework out of that. So some of it is just looking at the basics, you know, what are your demographics? Do you have a lot of new staff that are leaving within 6 months? Is that an area that we need to focus on? Do you have long retention but with lower engagement levels? So really understanding what is happening in your business, where needs the most support, or do you have, we spoke about leadership capability before, do you have a lot of leaders that are going into roles but then finding that they're very stressed and burnt out? So really doing that deep dive into the business, both from a demographic perspective, having a look at some of those reports, whether it's workers' compensation, EAP programs, you might be running an internal staff survey as well, just to get that pulse mark on what do employees want as well, because they equally need to have a voice in shaping a health and wellbeing program for it to be effective and to answer for some of those needs. And then bringing that together with clinical evidence-based programs to ensure that, you know, might be then creating different pillars of where you want to focus. So we'll see a lot of organizations focusing on physical health, mental health, and a social connection, for example, post-hybrid. So having that overarching vision of where it needs to be going, what are those pillars that can sit under it? And then it becomes easy to implement the right programs once you've understood what that driving need is.
Mm. Well, Mel, thank you so much for today. It's been a really good conversation, and I think the work that you're doing is really important work. And so I just want to thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, thank you so much, and thank you for creating this podcast. I've listened to some of your previous episodes as well, and I think it's just so important to realize that there's no one path in career journeys, are there? It's you know, learning as we go along the way, as we spoke about that job crafting to get you to where you want to be. But everybody's just had a fantastic story around how they got there, and I think the start and the end have been very different for most people, including yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. If people wanted to get in touch with you, where's the best place to do that?
Yeah, so on LinkedIn, you can find me for any corporate health and wellbeing questions or programs, just with my name, Melanie Moffat. And if you're after just some easy recipes or nutrition information, on Instagram on Vitalogic_AU or Facebook on under Vitalogic.
Awesome. All right, well, we'll link to all of those, and thanks for being on today.
Thanks so much for having me. Thanks, Alex. Bye.
Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And let's connect on LinkedIn so that we can keep the conversation going. Or head to my website and download my free resource, The Career Building Principles. Bye for now.